Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is shot and wounded when his anti-government protest convoy came under attack in the east of the country. Russia warns Britain of dangerous consequences after blaming London for an attack on the Russian Black Sea Fleet in Crimea last week. And at least four Palestinians are killed by Israeli forces in the occupied Jenin al-Quds. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has survived an assassination attempt during a political rally. He was shot in the leg, but now he is in a stable condition. Khan was taken to the hospital after his convoy was shot at near a city in Pakistan's east. A member of his party said several colleagues were also wounded, and there are reports that one has been killed. Pakistan's information minister says the suspect has been arrested. No one has yet been charged with involvement in the attack. Khan had been leading a march since last Friday from the city of Lahore towards the capital, Islamabad, campaigning for fresh elections after he was ousted from office this spring. Khan has repeatedly told supporters that he was prepared to die for the country, and aides have long warned of unspecified threats on his life. We can take a look at this a little closer. First, to get the latest, our correspondent Nasser Kazmi joins us from Islamabad. We also have Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London for an analysis. Well, Nasser Kazmi, at this point we've talked to you on a number of occasions, but still this is somewhat fresh in terms of the incident that has happened, and it's an assassination attempt on the former prime minister. What additional details can you give us at this point?
Well, the situation is under control at the moment where this attack had happened, and the police have also detained the attacker. The initial reports, the initial statement which were given by the attacker was that Imran Khan was misleading the people, so that's why he carried out this attack on him. And but Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party's leadership is not satisfied with the statement, and the party has directly accused Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, the Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and one of the senior military official for carrying this attack on Imran Khan. The party blamed that these three people were behind the assassination attempt. So in near future, you will see that the political turmoil will increase in Pakistan, as the PTI leadership is optimistic that if these three persons, including the Prime Minister of Pakistan, will not be removed from their positions, the party will carry on the protest countrywide. So as we have witnessed that the PTI supporters have blocked the key roads all across Pakistan, including federal capital Islamabad and the adjacent city Rawalpindi, and in Faisalabad we have received reports that the house of the interior minister was attacked by the angry protesters of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party. So at the moment, the ground situation is showing the turmoil in the country at the moment, and the government is trying to cope with the situation, and the government has assured that the high-profile inquiry of the incident would be held as according to the PTI's wishes. But the PTI leadership is not satisfied with the inquiry held so far. And as far as the Imran Khan health is concerned, he is stable. He is still under treatment in a hospital in Lahore. So the extra security measures have been taken all across the country to stop the protesters who have been protesting all across the country.
Saeed Mohsin Abbas, when we take a look at important events that have led up to this, it really goes back to when he was ousted from power, and then the claims that the former Prime Minister Khan made, which said that the U.S. had said, and he said directly, that it wanted the Prime Minister out. And we saw that that actually transpired. Are we looking at any type of perhaps involvement of the U.S. in this incident, which could be held according to Khan, in conjunction with perhaps the Pakistani military or elements within Pakistan?
Everything that happens in Pakistan politics has a link to the United States. The fact of the matter remains that Pakistan takes U.S. aid. Militarily, Pakistan is still reliant very much on military U.S. aid. The army, it seems to me, and if we're going to read between the lines rather than just tippy-tappy around, it seems to me that there's an internal potential struggle even within the Pakistan army as to the choice they have for the next part of this century, if you like, and that is that do Pakistan join the Eurasian axis, or do they go and continue under the coattails of the Anglo-Zionist empire? This is the straight choice, and Imran Khan was set upon, really, after he made moves, positive moves towards Russia, and didn't even condemn even the Ukraine scenario. His leaning towards the Eurasian axis, Imran Khan's leaning towards the Islamic Republic of Iran as well, its brotherly neighbor, also upset many people. But I think the manifestation of such an obvious attempt to assassinate Imran Khan, if that's indeed what this is really taking things to the next level, because he's blamed people from within the army as well. I think Major General Faisal in particular, I think that there is a kind of an ongoing situation in which he, I think, would be standing up, even to the extent that he is, unless there was some backing from within the Pakistan army. And that would then indicate that the Pakistan army is at sea in terms of which way it wants to go. The Americans want the oil and the resources, the gold, whatever lies in Balochistan. This is the main purpose of the Americans in Pakistan. They want Gwadar. They don't want the Chinese to have a complete run in Pakistan economically. They want to control most of the economic corridor there, or the Belt Road Initiative, which China is trying to obviously develop. They want to make sure that Iran and Pakistan don't form any kind of alliance. They want to control Pakistan's nuclear weapons as well. They want those completely under their control. And so all of this is inevitable. The struggle for Pakistan, a geopolitically absolutely vital area where China, the US, Russia, and the Islamic Republic have strong interests, not to mention India, of course, is, of course, a powder keg. And now, given the on-the-ground situation of, I think, internal disagreements, we're going to see it manifested increasingly in violence.
Our guest there, Nasser Kazemi, has indicated about the fact that Pakistan needs to make a choice. And I'm wondering if, do we still have Nasser Kazemi?
Yes.
Okay. I'm wondering if you have seen any signs or any indications as to whether there is anything that leads to that statement or that point of view. And of course, that when it comes to politics in Pakistan, I don't think you can separate the government from the powerful military. So any indications there as to what our guest there said about there being a choice that Pakistan needs to make, which would be either the government, the military, or in conjunction?
Well, we have to keep one thing in mind, that Imran Khan, since he was ousted from the power, he has been blaming the U.S., and his anti-establishment narrative was, you know, on the ground, and his popularity graph went very high in recent days, especially recently a journalist, Arshad Sharif, was murdered in Kenya, and the criticism which came after his assassination was recorded very high. So keeping all these aspects in mind, we have witnessed that one of the Prime Minister, Benazir Bhutto, was also assassinated in this country. And now the attack on Imran Khan has raised many questions that how this attack took place, especially when he was traveling his own government province, which was Punjab, which is governed by his party. So there are so many questions that needs answer at the moment, that how a political leader which has been saying that my life is under threat, and he was attacked today, and the political turmoil will definitely go further in the country, as we are expecting that this long march will arrive in Islamabad next week. But now many experts believe that this will fuel the tensions between the government, between the establishment, as well as the opposition and Imran Khan. So the days to come will be definitely will be recorded with more protests all across the country.
We do appreciate that. That was Syed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator. And also I would like to thank Nasser Kazmi, our correspondent there, who spoke to us from Islamabad. Thank you to you both. Moving on, tensions are escalating between Russia and Britain. Moscow summons the UK ambassador over what it has called Britain's involvement in an attack on Russia's Black Sea fleet in Crimea. Moscow says London helped Kiev carry out the drone attack last week. The Russian Foreign Ministry says such, quote, confrontational actions of Britain risk escalation of the situation. It has warned the UK of unpredictable and dangerous consequences of such moves. The two countries are also at loggerheads over attacks on the Nord Stream gas pipelines in September. Massive leaks and unprecedented damage to the pipelines were detected after multiple powerful explosions rocked them. Russia and several European countries called the incident an act of sabotage. London has denied Russia's accusations, saying that Moscow is trying to, quote, distract attention from its military failures in Ukraine. Thousands of people have gathered in Spain's capital, Madrid, to demand higher salaries amid the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The demonstration was called by major labor unions. The unions want the government and businesses to agree to raise the minimum wages in the face of rampant inflation. Like many European countries, Spain has seen price hikes due in large part to the war in Ukraine.
When consumer prices jump 10% and salaries rise by 1%, it means workers are losing purchasing power fast. We are getting poorer every day, and the worst part is that there is a minority getting richer at our expense.
Inflation in Spain peaked during the summer at under 11%. While it has slowed in October to reach over 7%, the figure is still higher than normal levels. Meanwhile, Eurozone consumer prices climbed at a record pace of over 10% last month. Food, fuel, rent, and home heating prices have been spiraling upwards in Europe as the continent braces for the worst to come in the winter. Israel keeps up its deadly violence against the Palestinians, with the regime forces killing four other people in the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, two were fatally shot in the city of Jenin, while four others suffered gunshot wounds. The military says Israeli forces also shot dead 20-year-old Bad Amr in Al-Quds, alleging that he attacked a group of officers with a knife. Israeli media are reporting three officers have been lightly injured in the stabbing. Separately, a fourth Palestinian man was shot and killed in northwestern Al-Quds. Israel has recently tightened its deadly grip on the West Bank and widened its crackdown on the Palestinians there. Over 140 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli regime troops in the West Bank this year alone. Downing Street says there are no plans to relocate the British Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Spokesperson for the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said there are no plans to follow former Prime Minister Liz Truss's orders to relocate the embassy. In September, Downing Street said Truss had discussed moving the current location of the British Embassy with Israel's caretaker Prime Minister Yair Lapid. This sparked anger and concern from Palestinian activists as well as resistance groups around the world. In 2018, former U.S. President Donald Trump moved the American embassy to Al-Quds, with three other states following suit. North Korea warns that Seoul and Washington have made a, quote, very risky and wrong decision by extending joint aerial drills. The secretary of the Central Committee of North Korea's ruling party said the two countries are pushing the circumstances out of control. He said that Seoul and Washington will ultimately come to know what a terrible mistake they have made. The warning comes as Seoul and Washington are conducting their largest ever joint air drills, involving hundreds of warplanes from both sides. Pyongyang views the drills as aggressive and an existential threat. The U.S. and South Korea say that they have agreed to extend the exercises beyond Friday, when the drills had been set to end. South Korea said earlier on Thursday that Pyongyang had launched multiple ballistic missiles.
This morning, our military detected the firing of one long-range ballistic missile from Sunan area in Pyongyang toward the East Sea, and two short-range ballistic missiles from Kaechon in South Pyongyang province toward the East Sea.
South Korean officials said Seoul will respond to any provocation from Pyongyang and track North Korea's movements in close cooperation with the U.S. According to the South Korean military, the intercontinental ballistic missile the North launched on Thursday likely failed in its flight. Hours later, Seoul said Pyongyang had fired an unspecified number of ballistic missiles. Just a day earlier, North Korea fired at least 23 missiles, the highest number in a single day. A UN report says opium cultivation in Afghanistan jumped 32% after the Taliban takeover. The report comes despite the group's ban on narcotics. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from Kabul.
Afghanistan's opium poppy cultivation has risen by a third over the past year, the UN's drugs agency said Tuesday. The UN body stated that the prices have risen after the Taliban's ban in April on poppy cultivation. The 2022 poppy crop was also the most profitable in years, according to the UNODC. The income made by farmers from opium sales more than tripled, hitting $1.4 billion, the report added. The Taliban officials, on the other hand, reject the UN body's finding, saying they are bringing poppy cultivation to zero.
We totally reject the UN's report. That is a baseless and incorrect report. No poppy cultivation has taken place in Afghanistan after the ban decree by the Taliban leader. The anti-narcotics unit of the Afghan Interior Ministry has had a lot of activities and achievements. We conducted nearly 2,000 anti-narco operations and arrested more than 2,000 suspected traffickers. We are fully watchful and won't let anyone cultivate or traffic the opiates.
The Taliban officials also echoed the UN drug agency's call on the international community to address the acute needs of Afghan people and to step up responses for the Afghan farmers. Taliban Deputy Economy Minister said the UN report was politically motivated. This comes as Afghanistan is also reeling from a drug addiction crisis. According to official reports, there are between 3.5 to 4 million addicts in Afghanistan. Decades of war and invasion have driven Afghanistan into a major field of poppy cultivation. It remains to be seen if the Taliban and the global community now help uproot this tragedy. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Birthday of Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam and heartiest congratulations to all our dear listeners on a day of rejoicing. Today, the 8th of Rabiul Thani, is the birthday of Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. And on this auspicious occasion, we present you a feature on the life and times of the 11th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Please stay with us. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, was born in Medina in the year 232 AH, corresponding to 845 AD, and was martyred at the young age of 28 years in Samarra in Iraq, where he and his father, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, were forcibly brought so that the tyrannical Abbasid regime could keep a watchful eye on the Prophet's righteous successors and the activities of their followers. His period of imamat, or divinely decreed leadership of mankind, was 6 years, during which he strove to enlighten the Ummah with the genuine precepts of Islam, despite the bouts of imprisonment and house arrest that he was subjected to. His mother was the pious Lady Salil, who was also called Susan and Hadithe. His wife was the spotlessly pious lady Hazrat Narjis, peace upon her, the granddaughter of the Byzantine emperor, while on her mother's side she was descended from Simon, the disciple and testamentary legatee of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him. Lady Narjis, peace upon her, was to give birth to a radiant boy who, as the son and successor of the 11th Imam, had to go into hiding or occultation by the will of God because of the persecution of the enemies, and will reappear in the end times as Qa'imul Mahdi to cleanse the earth of all vestiges of oppression and corruption, and to establish the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, like his forebears, was the picture of moral excellence and perfection. He was peerless in knowledge, forbearance, forgiveness, generosity, sacrifice, and piety. Whenever the Caliph Mu'tamid asked anybody about his captive, Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, he was told that he fasted during the day and worshipped during the night, and that his tongue uttered no word but remembrance of the Almighty Creator. During the brief periods of freedom and a stay at home, people approached him to avail from his benevolence, and they went back well rewarded. Once, when the Abbasid Caliph asked Ahmad ibn Ubaidullah ibn Khaqan, his minister for Awqaf or endowments, about the descendants of Imam Ali, peace upon him, he reported, "I do not know anybody among them who is more distinguished than Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him. None can surpass him in dignity, knowledge, piety, and abstinence, nor can anybody match him in the point of nobleness, majestic grandeur, modesty, and honesty." Once, when the Caliph Mu'taz, during a march past of the seemingly powerful Abbasid army that was a terror from Europe and Africa to the borders of China and India, tried to ridicule the 11th Imam by asking him, "Where is your army?" the Imam gently raised his hand and asked the Caliph to have a look through two of his parted fingers. What the haughty Mu'taz saw in bewilderment and awe and with a quaking heart was an assembly of angels stretching all the way towards the sky, and ready to annihilate the opposite forces if commanded. This explains the epithet al-Askari, Arabic for military forces, that the 11th heir of Prophet came to acquire. Imam Hassan Askari, peace upon him, strove to steer societies to the shores of salvation by enlightening them with the purpose of creation, the duty towards God, obligation to God's Prophet, cognizance of the Prophet's divinely designated successors, and respect for the rights of mankind, in order to pave the way for the ideal society that his son and successor will accomplish. May God hasten the reappearance of the 12th Imam, an establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. In order to help Muslims stay firm on the path of God during the long period of occultation of his son and successor, the promised Mahdi, peace upon him, the 11th Imam expressed the following gem of a statement. It is obligatory for the people to follow the jurist who refrains from committing wrong, emphasizes his faith, opposes carnal desires, and obeys Allah's command. Here we present you excerpts of the 11th Imam's wonderful epistle to an Iranian Muslim, Ishaq ibn Ismail Nishaburi of Khorasan. You should know fully well, Ishaq, that whoever quits this world with blindness to facts and realities will be also blind in the world to come and in terrible error. O Ishaq, it is not the sights that are affected with blindness. In fact, it is the hearts that are in the chest. This is confirmed by God's citing of the saying of the wicked in his book of wisdom, Surah Taha, ayahs 124 and 125. And on the day of resurrection, we shall raise him blind. He will say, "My Lord, why have you raised me blind, though I used to see?" God will say, "So it is. Our signs came to you, but you forgot them, and thus you are forgotten on this day." In conclusion of our special feature, here are some wise sayings from the 11th Imam, which is indeed worth pondering upon. Generosity has a limit. When crossed, becomes extravagance. Caution has a limit. When crossed, becomes cowardice. Thriftiness has a limit. When crossed, becomes miserliness. Courage has a limit. When crossed, becomes foolhardiness. Let this moral lesson suffice. Refrain from doing anything which you would disapprove of it if done by someone else. Reasonless laughter is a sign of ignorance. The worst servants of God are those who are two-faced and two-tongued. They praise their present friends and backbite the absent. They envy them for obtaining graces and disappoint them when they suffer a misfortune. The most pious of people is he who stops at suspicious matters. The best worshipper is he who performs the obligatory religious affairs duly. The most abstinent of people is he who refrains from the unlawful. The most hardworking of people is he who keeps away from sins.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It was a long wait that ended in a cry of joy. Former president and left-wing candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won the second round of the Brazilian presidential election against the incumbent far-right leader Jair Bolsonaro. With 50.9% of the vote, the leader of the Workers' Party obtained a narrow victory over his opponent, who received 49.1% of the vote. The election was Brazil's most polarizing poll since its return to democracy in 1985 after a military dictatorship. It also marked the first time that the sitting president failed to win re-election. Just over 2 million votes separated the two candidates. Addressing his supporters in a speech following the announcement of his victory, the newly elected president promised to unite a divided country. The veteran leftist leader said his win is a victory for a democratic movement above the interests of parties and ideologies.
This is not my victory, nor of the Workers' Party, nor of the parties that supported me in the campaign. It is a victory of the immense democratic movement that was created beyond the political parties, individual interests and ideologies for democracy to win.
Lula made a stunning comeback while the public credited him with building an extensive social welfare program during his previous tenure in office, helping lift millions into the middle class and being in charge of a booming economy. During the election campaigns, Bolsonaro tried to shift the debate to Lula's corruption convictions in 2018, which were later overturned by the country's top court. However, he failed. Bolsonaro's popularity never exceeded 40% during his 4 years in office. He faced wide criticism over a slew of issues, including his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, inflation, and high fuel prices. He has been widely criticized by public health experts for his failure to respond to the pandemic in a timely fashion and reluctance to introduce restrictive measures in fear of damaging the economy. Just 4 out of 10 households have access to food of adequate quality and quantity. The majority, 58.7%, live with some level of food insecurity. This is equivalent to around 125 million people. Also, large-scale deforestation of the Amazon accelerated under Bolsonaro, reaching a 15-year high in 2021. In his third term, Lula has inherited a sluggish economy, tighter budget constraints, and a more hostile legislature from the country's most right-wing government in decades. Lula has vowed a return to state-driven economic growth and social policies that helped lift millions out of poverty when he governed Brazil from 2003 to 2010. Soon after the announcement of Lula's victory in the tight runoff presidential vote, congratulations poured in. Among the list of world leaders who rushed to express their joy about Lula's victory was a long list of regional leftist leaders, including Argentina's Alberto Fernandez and Mexico's Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Lula's win is the latest example of Latin American countries choosing to dethrone incumbent parties on the right and center-right of the political spectrum. From Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, The region's political map suggests Latin America is set to see a new wave of pink tide of leftist governments that swept into power in the 1990s. The return of leftist governments in the region would bring closer cooperation across Latin America and is a clear indication of region-wide rejection of U.S. policies. Experts believe that the emergence of leftist politicians in Latin America will expand China's circle of friends in the region based on the fact that Latin America will attach more importance to political and economic cooperation with Beijing. Washington has for years backed the wrong players in the region, many educated or trained in the U.S., but Americans have turned a blind eye to the civil society's demands for change in the region, which has meant the departure of the U.S. favorite actors.
The German Chancellor and the French President met in Paris to recalibrate their relations, as there seems to be a rise in tensions over issues related to energy, economy, and defense between Europe's two biggest economies. Germany and France are the driving forces behind many of the key decisions made by the European Union, such as a plan to raise billions of euros in debt to cushion the blow of the pandemic.
We are the biggest supporter of Europe. We are paying 26% of the budget usually, and we are developing a lot of solidarity mechanisms, as we did in the last crisis, looking at Corona, with the instruments we developed with the RRF and the recovery fund is a good chance for acting together also in the time we have now.
But amongst the differences in their policies that have become cause for fallouts, Scholz and Macron seem to be on the same page when it comes to seeing European investments being hijacked by the US as a result of new policies in Washington. Macron believes that as businesses are given incentive to, quote, buy American, France will lose 8 billion euros. What Macron is referring to exactly is the biggest climate and energy package in US history, recently signed by Joe Biden. The Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, or the IRA, includes $600 billion in spending in total, with $370 billion dedicated to supporting renewable energy and climate resilience. Washington is hoping to find the budget for the package by sorting out large corporations' long-running tax evasions, as well as those of the top 1%, whether or not the corporations and the elite will still be able to evade taxes as they've been doing for so long remains to be seen, though. One of the measures in the IRA includes tax rebates for buyers of American-made electric vehicles, among many other industry credits for clean energy initiatives. These incentives will move operations from France to the US to take advantage of these subsidies, according to Macron. He's even called the IRA measures unfairly protectionist. There is agreement among the EU bloc members that tangible and concrete measures need to be taken. Among the potential responses that the EU could give to the IRA policy is filing a complaint to the World Trade Organization that would call for adding European-made products to become a part of the US rebate plan. In an interview with France 2 TV channel, Emmanuel Macron proposed his response to the US measure. We need a Buy European Act like the Americans. We need to reserve our subsidies for our European manufacturers. Macron even referred to similar policies in China, saying, you have China that is protecting its industry, the US that is protecting its industry, and Europe that is an open house. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, while not a big fan of the bi-European rhetoric, shares Macron's concerns over the unfair US competition. He is especially hurt when he found out that German chemical giant BASF is planning to cut down its business activities in Germany, as the company's chief says the gas prices in Germany are 6 times higher than in the US, and increasing EU regulations aren't helping his business either. German Finance Minister Christian Lindner has acknowledged that and responded by saying, the decision of a successful company like BASF showed that we need to improve the overall attractiveness of Germany as a business location. He also said Germany needs to pursue tax reliefs for private investors. Now Scholz and Macron are trying to reach an agreement with Washington to sort out their differences through a newly formed US-EU task force on the Inflation Reduction Act.
Whoa, ladies and gentlemen, after years and years of hard work, it's official. Micron is coming to Central New York.
It remains to be seen whether the deindustrialization that is plaguing Europe, mainly as a result of the energy crunch that is causing the exodus of European countries from the bloc, but now also because of Washington's incentives for investors in the US, can be fixed through reaching a compromise with the US. Because the alternative would be either a transatlantic trade war or an even bigger economic slump for a Europe unattractive to companies and investors, new and old.
A special meeting has been held by the UN, titled UN Security Council Counterterrorism. The focus was on technology and the rapid rise in digitization, the use of new and emerging technologies to counter terrorism. In the meeting, the UN cited the important roles that victims and their networks can play in countering terrorism, and to pay tribute to India and how it was a terrorism victim back in 2008.
Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me extend a warm welcome to all of you in Mumbai, the financial capital of India, for attending this soft opening of the special meeting of the Counter-Terrorism Committee of the Security Council, as well as the informal briefing on countering the financing of terrorism in national and regional context.
Yet there was one country that was not mentioned, one which has been a victim of terrorism, one which was a victim of a terrorist attack just the day before, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. representative at the UN, Chris Liu, said things like, "Today was a powerful reminder that this is really about people's lives." He also said, "We send our sympathies to the Indian people, we stand in solidarity with them, and we are committed to ensuring that the perpetrators of this horrific attack are brought to justice." But no mention of Iran, especially since it lost 13 lives due to a terrorist attack, or the over 17,000 lives that it lost due to the MKO terrorist cult. Not that Iran was looking for sympathy from the U.S. After all, Iran's top intelligence bodies issued a joint statement just yesterday pointing to the major role of foreign intelligence agencies, especially the CIA, in orchestrating the violent riots in Iran in the past weeks. The announcement said intelligence evidence shows that the CIA had devised an extensive plan with the cooperation of allied spy services and reactionary proxies before the start of the unrest to initiate a nationwide chaos with the aim of committing crimes against the great Iranian nation. In short, the intelligence ministries said the CIA played the main role while closely cooperating with the spy agencies of the UK, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. This should not come as a surprise, especially since the U.S. has executed color revolutions. In short, exporting wars, launching color revolutions, fomenting extremist ideologies, and promoting economic instability, especially through sanctions, are just some of the actions by the U.S. which has resulted in bloodshed and turmoil around the world. Some of those countries include Cuba, Ukraine, Syria, Iran, and Venezuela. Here is a man who has openly advocated for support for these rioters and who has said that the U.S. has been involved in U.S. regime change operations, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat, yeah, not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt.
But Iran has been one of the biggest victims of terrorism. Deputy Chief of Iran's Judiciary and head of the country's human rights headquarters, Kazem Gharibabadi, has blamed Western countries for their double standard policies on terrorism and described his nation as the biggest victim of terrorism. He said on the one hand, they accuse Iran of violating human rights, but on the other, they martyr 17,000 innocent Iranian citizens through terrorism or violate the rights of millions of Iranians through the imposition of unilateral sanctions and jeopardize their right to life. The U.S. administration and its allies are now looking to convene an informal private meeting of the U.N. Security Council on recent Iranian riots as an attempt to advance their political agenda. Imagine that, the ones committing instability in Iran to then discuss Iran's domestic affairs, among them the recent violent riots. The Iranian reaction has been swift. Iran's permanent mission to the UN said, given the hypocrisy and the use of double standards and selective practice of human rights, we regard American claims in support of Iranian women to be deceptive and lacking in good faith. He also stressed that based on reports by Iran's intelligence community, the U.S. itself was the main suspect behind the recent riots in Iran. And to make the situation even more hypocritical, according to a note outlining the events, it said it's the U.S. and Albania which will hold the informal U.N. Security Council gathering to happen on Wednesday. Of all countries, Albania, which has for years hosted anti-Iran terrorists in collusion with the U.S., the MKO, the same terrorist cult which the U.S. named as a terrorist entity once, but then took that label away. Albania does not only host this terrorist cult, but it has turned its country into a hub of interference by the terrorist group and countries hostile to Iran. It enjoys freedom of activity, even after being delisted by the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012 respectively of the terrorist label. So it came as no surprise that the MKO terrorist cult was also actively involved in the recent riots in Iran. The findings of Iran's top intelligence body said that 49 MKO terrorists have been arrested. The terrorists were responsible for spreading fake news, instructing rioters to organize acts of terror and destruction, to direct slogans, and to be present on the streets to damage public property. This was in addition to the 77 members of anti-Iran terrorist groups that had also been arrested in the Iraqi Kurdistan region. 5 members of the Takfiri terrorist groups were also arrested in possession of 36 kilograms of explosives that were to be used to carry out bombings and gatherings. The ministry has further announced that 92 people affiliated with the former U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime had been arrested. It added that 9 nationals from Germany, Poland, Italy, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden were also arrested during the riots. Iranian intelligence ministry said a significant number of pistols, various types of machine guns and cartridges, as well as shotguns and ammunition were also seized. So it is quite hypocritical that the U.S. and its European allies impose sanctions on Iran for what they claim is a heavy-handed crackdown on violent protesters, and then move to convene a UN session on how to ratchet up further pressure on the Iranian government. Hypocritical also, since the U.S. and these European countries have all been doing the same to their own population, especially the U.S.
After the Friday prayers, people of Iran poured into the streets to express their disgust at the heinous act of terror by Daesh Takfiri terrorists and ask for revenge against the group. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has already assured the nation that the perpetrators will face due punishment. President Ebrahim Raisi has also said that the root cause of the crime has been identified and that Iran will deliver a decisive blow to the architects and operatives of this plot, a blow that will make them regret ever committing such act. Daesh had already tried to pull off similar terrorist attacks in the country when they plotted the parliament attack and the bombing of Ayatollah Khomeini's mausoleum that left a dozen Iranians dead. Iran's anti-terror attacks ramped up significantly following the attacks on its soil through Iran's martyred anti-terror icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. While these were the only attacks on Iran claimed by Daesh, there have been several other terrorist attacks by other, more globally obscure but equally vicious groups. Among them, the Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, has the highest body count. 17,000 Iranians have died at the hands of the vile group that even joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq war to carry out cross-border attacks. For years, the group was even on the U.S. list of terrorist groups before it was removed from the list in 2012 to receive funding more easily. Funding such as the massive annual events that the MKO manages to organize without having any backing by the people of Iran, neither inside the country nor outside. These events are often attended by top U.S. officials such as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, or a number of British members of parliament to at least attempt to give the so-called Free Iran Conventions the legitimacy it sorely lacks. Among other terrorist groups that, while definitely not on the scale of the previously mentioned two, have still tried to deprive Iran of its security, we can name Jandallah terrorist group led by Abdul Malik Righi. Righi's group was responsible for the death of tens of Iranians in the southeast province of Sistan and Baluchistan before he was arrested and executed by Iranian authorities. Separatist groups such as Al-Ahwaziyya and the Kurdish Komala have also been responsible for a few terrorist attacks in the west of Iran, with the latter serving a prominent role in the recent riots across the country. But their plot to capitalize on the riots to further their separatist agendas was quickly foiled by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The IRGC carried out two ballistic missile attacks on Komala's bases in Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC had warned Iraq prior to the attack that Iran will not tolerate the existence of such groups who were, as reported by the IRGC, plotting to attack western Iran in its neighborhood. According to a joint statement between Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and the intelligence organization of the IRGC, involvement of the U.S. in the recent riots in Iran has been proven. The U.S. and its spy agencies have even branched out their plans in three stages: before, during, and after the unrests. The CIA is referred to in the joint statement as the main culprit for inciting the riots. But the CIA is aided by Israel's Mossad and Saudi Foreign Intelligence Services, with the help of the most vicious of terrorist groups. Inciting despair among the Iranian population with the help of the massive amounts of funding that is given to foreign Farsi-speaking media outlets is listed among the primary tactics used to incite the unrests. Teaching effective escalation tactics during unrests have also been documented as another tactic used by the spy agencies. But among the many other items listed, none of them would be possible without the massive funding that the US, UK, Israel, and their Saudi allies give to the media outlets and individuals who capitalize on people's emotions. Also, supposedly international platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter freely violate their own rules in this particular case and allow posts that incite violence to be freely uploaded onto their platforms. An extra $53 million have also been allocated by the CIA to give to these Farsi-speaking media outlets and individuals on top of their annual payments. Israeli influence, however, should not be ignored. Just recently, the IRGC dismantled a network of Mossad-affiliated terrorists in West Azerbaijan province. The investment of these spy agencies in inciting unrest in Iran has been proven time and time again, and cannot possibly fit into a short clip. Rest assured, you will hear about more evidence of foreign meddling in Iran's recent riots in the days and weeks to come.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.